effective. To do that, let's leave sports behind for a moment and focus on your own jobs. Most of you listening to this right now make a living working for someone or something. Some of you, like me, are lucky enough to own your own businesses, but even those of us who own our own businesses have to make money somehow. That is, we're responsive to a marketplace of consumers. If we alienate our marketplace of consumers, our revenue declines. If someone purchased this book, they will have received the book via mail delivery either at home or your office from UPS, FedEx, or the United States Postal Service. If you were home when this book arrived, you might well have opened the door and had this package handed directly to you. If that happened, then you received this package from a man or woman in a uniform, either the brown UPS uniform, the blue, black, red, and white of FedEx, or the multiple blues of the United States Postal Service. Other than potentially commenting on the weather or giving a general greeting, odds are the person delivering this book said nothing to you of any substantial nature. He or she just did their job. When he drove away, other than the logo of his company on the side of the vehicle, there was nothing to tell you anything about your delivery man's employer either. Now imagine your reaction. If when you'd purchased this book and it had been delivered at your house, he'd been wearing a Make America Great Again hat, or his shirt had been emblazoned by an I'm With Her pendant that you found impossible to ignore. If, in addition to these clear political statements, he'd also encouraged you to vote for a Republican or Democrat, and when he'd driven off, you'd seen one of their political stickers emblazoned on his work vehicle, you'd have probably found this a bit strange. Leaving aside what UPS, FedEx, or even more substantially the U.S. Postal Service, since it's a government entity, might think about their employees' behavior, I think all of you would agree that it would be bad for the delivery business to endorse one political side or the other. Half of you voted for Trump, half of you voted for Hillary, but the business needs to serve everyone. Why alienate half of your customers for no reason? If a FedEx, UPS, or Postal Service employee advocated for a politician on the job, he'd be fired, maybe the first time he did it. And certainly by the second or third time. Every single one of you reading this right now would have understood that decision. I bet every single one of you, however, would also agree that the FedEx, UPS, or Postal Service employee has the absolute right to put a political sticker on his own private vehicle and drive that to work. And I bet that all of you would agree that outside of his or her own home, that employee could also put up a yard sign supporting a candidate or political party of his or her own choice. In America, we understand that there is a difference between political speech at work and political speech outside of work. Now let's take my example outside of the delivery business. Let's go inside Walmart or McDonald's, two of the biggest employers in the country. What would you think if you ordered a Big Mac, fries, and a Coke, and when your meal came, the McDonald's worker told you, "Abortion is murder. I hope you'll support candidates who agree in the next election." Or the statement was pro-choice, "The politics don't matter, just that they're being expressed at work in a uniform." Or if when you checked out of Walmart, the Walmart employee in uniform said as he scanned your kid's latest Xbox game, "Gay marriage is an affront to civilized society, and God will damn us for allowing it." Or the opposite side of this political equation, again, the politics don't matter. I think all of you reading this right now would agree that the FedEx, UPS, USPS, McDonald's, or Walmart employee would be out of line for sharing his or her political opinion with you while in uniform at work. Regardless of whether you agreed or disagreed with the political opinion, you'd agree it was a bad idea for a company that existed to serve all Americans to pick sides in an evenly divided country. It's not just private employers either. If a police officer pulled you over and was wearing a Make America Great Again hat above his uniform, this would go viral in an instant on social media, and the officer would be fired or reprimanded within hours. Our own United States military members are not allowed to advocate for political candidates in uniform for this exact reason. Now, having left the world of sports, let's go back to sports. If you agree with me that all of those employees would be behaving inappropriately by advocating their political opinions while in uniform at work, Why should Colin Kaepernick be able to advocate for his political beliefs while in uniform at work? Put simply, he shouldn't. The NFL had a specific rule that mandated that players stand for the national anthem, and a punishment could have swiftly nipped this form of protest in the bud. What I said at the time and continue to say is that the NFL should have immediately fined Kaepernick for refusing to stand for the national anthem and donated all the money to a Wounded Warriors fund. That way Kaepernick could have made his political statement, but money could have gone directly to members of the military. I suspect the outrage would have been minimal, and the likelihood of the protest continuing beyond a season or even a few games would have been low. If Roger Goodell had been smart, he would have studied the NBA's reaction to Mahmoud Abdul-Rauf's protest and cited it as precedent when he made his own decision. Furthermore, it's not as if NFL players have unrestricted First Amendment rights on the field anyway. The NFL already suspends, fines, and penalizes players on a regular basis for a variety of on-field acts, be it illegal hits, improper touchdown celebrations, or uniform violations. The idea that players have full freedom of speech on the football field is laughably absurd. The NFL even fines players for inappropriate on-field language, something Colin Kaepernick should know about since he was called for a penalty and fined for using a racial slur on the field during game action in 2014. Instead of undertaking these actions, the NFL didn't do anything for the entire season about Colin Kaepernick's protest, even as it spread to additional players, and even as the league's ratings plummeted by 8% in 2016. The NFL didn't come up with a policy that made sense in the entire 2016 offseason either, even as the Colin Kaepernick free agency drama occupied months of attention. When Kaepernick wasn't signed, he sued the league for collusion. Why do I believe Kaepernick wasn't signed? Because Kaepernick's talents weren't good enough to justify the business hit that many NFL teams would take for signing him. His problems exceeded his talents. If Aaron Rodgers, Russell Wilson, Tom Brady, Matt Ryan, Cam Newton, or Drew Brees had knelt to make a political statement, it wouldn't have mattered what cause they had espoused. Aaron Rodgers could have knelt and expressed sympathy for ISIS, and just about every NFL team would have tried to sign him if he were a free agent. But who wants a backup quarterback who alienates at least half of your fan base and is unlikely to start, barring an injury? NFL coaches don't want distractions in the locker room, particularly distractions that aren't good enough to win them games. In his final 18 games as a starting NFL quarterback, Kaepernick went 2-16 with the San Francisco 49ers. Remember that he'd been beaten out by Blaine Gabbert. Blaine Gabbert! Before his protest began in the late summer of 2016. Maybe Kaepernick will be signed before the 2018 football season, but my guess is his problems will still exceed his talents. At press time, that's the case. Faced with an entire season to come up with a solution to the Kaepernick problem, the NFL did nothing, hoping the issue would just go away. Then 2017 happened, and Donald Trump dove headlong into the controversy that I saw brewing in my own family. Addressing an Alabama audience on a Friday night before a weekend of football in September of 2017, Trump attacked Colin Kaepernick in the NFL. Wouldn't you love to see one of these NFL owners, when somebody disrespects our flag, to say, "Get that son of a bitch off the field right now. Out. He's fired. He's fired." You know some owner is going to do that. He's going to say, "That guy that disrespects our flag, he's fired." And that owner, they don't know it. They don't know it. They'll be the most popular person for a week. They'll be the most popular person in this country. Trump continued, "But you know what's hurting the game more than that? When people like yourselves turn on television and you see those people taking the knee when they are playing our great national anthem. The only thing you could do better is if you see it, even if it's one player, leave the stadium. I guarantee things will stop. Things will stop. Just pick up and leave. Pick up and leave. Not the same game anymore anyway." Trump's base exploded with glee, and NFL players who live in a world where everyone has to be perpetually offended kneeled in mass protest of Trump's comments. including, ironically, some NFL players overseas in London who stood for the British national anthem and then kneeled for the American national anthem, evidently having forgotten that we had to go to war with Britain to gain our own independence. In total, roughly 180 players kneeled the weekend after Trump's comments. Closer to home, my own Tennessee Titans team, located in a blue city in a deeply red state that Donald Trump won with ease, elected not to take the field for the national anthem before their game against the Seattle Seahawks. I'm politically moderate, and as I discussed earlier, not wedded to the idea of playing the national anthem before sporting events. I voted for the Libertarian Gary Johnson in the 2016 presidential election, but the decision took away my enjoyment of the beginning of the game. Fans roundly booed the team, and in subsequent days, one of the Titans' top players, tight end Delanie Walker, had this to say, "And the fans that don't want to come to the game, I mean, okay, bye. I mean, if you feel that's something we're disrespecting you, don't come to the game. You don't have to. No one's telling you to come to the game. It's your freedom of choice to do that." Titan cornerback Logan Ryan followed up by saying, "If they don't want to watch, that's their choice. That's perfect." Are you kidding me? This is insanity. Do the players not realize that it's the fans who pay their salaries? What's more, the NFL players receive 47% of all NFL revenues. If you alienate your fan base, then eventually your salary goes down. That's why it's unfortunate that the NFL signs multi-year deals with TV partners, because I guarantee you this protest would have stopped really quickly if every NFL player suddenly started receiving 20% less in every paycheck to reflect the declining TV ratings. It's one thing to support Kaepernick in theory, but how many NFL players would support Kaepernick if it cost them 20% of their salary? Virtually none, I'd wager. Comments like these from Tennessee Titans players represented the ultimate disconnect between players and fans and reflected a larger issue, long sublimated by the ability of sports to unite fans despite our political persuasions. How would a league and ownership made up mostly of white Republican voters and owners handle a crisis brought to bear on behalf of a league that was over 70% black and Democratic? As if that weren't enough, the NFL was incapable of breaking the political tide. To combat the tanking ratings and overall politicization of the league, NFL owners met in New York City to suggest solutions. That meeting did not go well. Houston Texans owner Bob McNair referenced the tenuous state the league found itself in and said, as a result of the protest, "We can't have the inmates running the prison." McNair managed to mangle a popular idiom, "We can't have the inmates running the asylum," and NFL players lost their minds when ESPN reported his quote and then spent multiple days covering the reaction to the quote too. At no point in ESPN's coverage did they explain that the phrase was a common idiom and not to be taken literally. That's even though presumably ESPN employs many people who knew this. Why temper the racial antagonism in sports when you can inflame it? Believing not that the Texans owner had messed up a common saying, but that he had called them all inmates at work in a prison, multiple Texans players left work. The player reaction to McNair's comment then became lead news as well. Here are some popular sports idioms. The ball is in your court. That's par for the course. He hit a home run. She is out of her league. We're coming down the home stretch. Down for the count. Full court press. Move the goalpost. Keep your eye on the ball. Lightweight. Saved by the bell. And even the name of my website, Outkick the Coverage. And that's just idioms derived from sports. Our regular day speech is peppered with idioms, words that don't literally translate to how they're used. Here are a few more. Piece of cake. That costs an arm and a leg. Hit the nail on the head. You can't judge a book by its cover. There's more than one way to skin a cat. When pigs fly, a penny for your thoughts. The point of these examples is that none of these are literal statements. If I said curiosity killed the cat, would any of you wonder why curiosity wasn't being charged with animal cruelty? I mean any of you who don't play football for the Houston Texans. The Houston Texans owner should be thanking his lucky stars he didn't say, "We can't let the monkeys run the zoo," because if he'd said that, he would have been led before a firing squad and publicly executed immediately before the national anthem. Idioms are hate crimes, y'all. It's impossible for the country to get any dumber. Until next year, when the Houston Texans will probably take a knee to protest the pot calling the kettle black. Racist! Of course, player stupidity is one thing. It's probably even too much to expect your average athlete to know idioms exist, much less use them correctly. That's especially the case when we're in an era when Golden State Warriors forward Draymond Green asked to comment on what the Texans owner said, confidently opined, "You can't use figures of speech in 2017. Me. And just when I signed a book deal too? It's going to be awfully hard not to use similes, metaphors, puns, personifications, hyperbole, understatements, paradoxes, and oxymorons in modern day language anymore. Fun fact for athletes out there, an oxymoron isn't related to a moron, and satire isn't part of a car either. Shouldn't we at least expect for sports media members who are theoretically better educated than athletes and have read a book for fun in their lives to point out that what Bob McNair said in a private meeting was a common idiomatic phrase and that he wasn't in any way comparing players to inmates or his team to a prison? You might expect that, but you'd be wrong. There was money to be made turning this into racism. The liberal sports media, led by the usual suspects at MSESPN, went right to work turning this into a modern-day civil rights issue, laced with racism and inappropriate commentary. The sports media commentary reached laughably absurd heights of stupidity when former NFL player Charles Woodson, appearing on ESPN's pregame show on Sunday before kickoff, said he refused to use the O word. Which O word? Owner. Then Randy Moss, the greatest wide receiver in league history, felt compelled to point out that NFL team owners didn't own the players. Thanks, Randy. Seriously, this happened on MSESPN and its actual pregame coverage for the NFL. No wonder that show's ratings were down double digits in 2017. Do you know any NFL fans who want to tune in to an NFL pregame show and be told that using the word owner is unacceptable? Or be told that team owners don't actually own the players? This is the depth of the problem the NFL found itself in during 2017 when suddenly everything was racist and unacceptable. Houston Texans owner Bob McNair would apologize for the comments in 2017 and then take back the apology in 2018, claiming that he'd been referring to the league's commissioner and executives and their management of the political crisis and not the players. Regardless, proving that what goes viral is often nonsensical and artificially divisive, McNair was so committed to racial healing that he'd quietly paid for every black victim of the Charleston, South Carolina church shooting's funeral. Remarkably, that story received a thousandth of the coverage of his comments in the private NFL meeting. Even if you thought McNair's idiom was poorly chosen and you wanted to take it literally, the allegation that it was racist didn't make sense. After all, the Texans are not an entirely black team. There are white players as well. Didn't it require the listener to be racist to infer the Texans owner was calling only his black players inmates in prison? And then to equate the black players with inmates because black people are in jail in substantial numbers in this country? That's especially the case since more than half of the prison inmates in this country are white, meaning this racist connection isn't even accurate. Shouldn't the white players have been even more outraged by the comments since they make up the majority of prison inmates? According to the most recent Bureau of Prisons data, white people make up 58.4% of prisoners and black people make up 37.9% of prisoners. While McNair apologized for the comments both immediately upon saying them in the private meeting and later publicly when his quote came out, he shouldn't have. He should have said, "I apologize for using a popular idiom that most people in America today are too dumb to understand. What I should have said was this, so everyone, even the idiots, would understand me perfectly. I believe NFL players kneeling for the national anthem is incredibly bad for the NFL, and I think it's a perfect example of employees ruining a business. So from this point forward, let me be abundantly clear. If you have an issue with the way I run this team, you are welcome to seek employment elsewhere, because I will not allow the actions of a few idiots to ruin my business in the great state of Texas. Boom! He might have gotten elected governor of Texas on the spot. So what was the final team reaction to McNair's comments? The Houston Texans protested the national anthem by kneeling because their owner used an idiom they didn't recognize. What in the world had the national anthem done to deserve disrespect? Yet in so doing, the players actually proved McNair's exact point by executing this protest, that the inmates were running the asylum in the NFL. Worst of all for the NFL, the politicization of the league's sport, now aided by attacks from Donald Trump, was causing fans to abandon the league in massive numbers, including in my own family. My father-in-law is a lifelong woebegone Detroit Lions fan. Every year that I have known him, come Thanksgiving, he's put on the Lions game, and we've watched the team play as a prelude to our Thanksgiving meal. He even bought tickets for my wife and me to attend a Titans-Lions game on Thanksgiving in Detroit back in 2008. This past year at Thanksgiving, I noticed something strange. My father-in-law didn't have the game on as we prepared for Thanksgiving dinner. I asked him to put the game on because I'd bet money on the Lions. It was a bad bet, go figure. He told me that he'd stopped watching the NFL because he was fed up with turning on football games and seeing protests and having to hear about politics during football. My father-in-law is an independent voter, having supported Democratic and Republican candidates in the past, but he abandoned the NFL in 2017. Millions more did the same. The result? NFL ratings plunged by an additional double-digit decline in 2017. That was after going down 8% in 2016. That means league ratings were down nearly 20% overall from 2015 in a pre-protest NFL. Now, many prognosticators have blamed a variety of reasons for the NFL's ratings decline, and ratings remain strong for the league in a vacuum. From cord-cutting to Netflix to poor play to injuries to the presidential race and politics in general sweeping away the nation's attention. But the number one reason I hear for why fans abandon the league is because of the overall politicization of the NFL. During the course of 2017, the NFL became one of the most polarizing brands in America. The most polarizing brands in 2017 were as follows: Trump Hotels, CNN, Fox News, NBC News, The New York Times, MSNBC, and the NFL. The NFL had become the seventh most polarizing brand in America in the wake of Colin Kaepernick's protest and Donald Trump's comments on NFL players kneeling. That's incredible. After doing nothing for 2 years, the NFL finally implemented a new policy for the anthem in May of 2018. Players were to stand for the anthem if they were on the field, but they could also remain in the locker room if they didn't want to stand for the anthem. Teams, not players, would be fined for players failing to stand for the anthem. With this new policy, the NFL believed it enacted a perfect compromise. The reality was something different. Players were furious and the controversy exploded anew. This happened despite the fact that the NFL anthem policy was even more lenient than the NBA's policy for the anthem. As the Philadelphia Eagles prepared to visit the White House to celebrate their Super Bowl win, a brand new controversy erupted over that visit, and President Trump canceled the celebration when he alleged players were planning to not show up for the event. Recognizing that his base of Republican supporters believed the players should stand, Trump repeatedly attacked the NFL for its new policy and demanded that all players stand for the anthem. The far left-wing sports media praised the Eagles players for their courageous stand, which was, of course, the exact opposite stance the sports media had adopted in 2012 when Boston Bruins goalie Tim Thomas elected not to attend the White House celebration over his disagreement with Obama's politics. Back in 2012, ESPN, Sports Illustrated, Bleacher Report, The Huffington Post, and Newsweek had all featured front page articles crushing Thomas for his decision to put politics in front of his team's celebration. The reaction in 2018, every one of those sites ran articles praising the Eagles for their courage, bravery, and commitment to political activism. I'd like to say I was surprised, but it was exactly what I expected. The sports media didn't apply the same logic to Tim Thomas as they had to the Eagles. They praised the Eagles and crushed Thomas. The only difference, which political party the athletes supported. Whether you agree or disagree with Trump on the anthem issue, the politics here are clear. Trump wins, bigly. Why? Because unlike the NFL, Trump doesn't have to please the entire country. He just needs 270 electoral votes. The NFL has fans with a variety of opinions on the national anthem. Trump's fans have just one stand. The NFL's failure to act on Kaepernick's protest has allowed Donald Trump to seize control of a divisive cultural battle. By politicizing the anthem, Kaepernick's protest created an equal and potentially more fervent reaction, and Donald Trump was capitalizing on the NFL's mess. To make his anthem point abundantly clear, Trump arrived at the college football national title game between Alabama and Georgia and strode onto the field, where he proceeded to put his hand on his heart for the national anthem before the game. The move stunned organizers of the game, who were told only a few minutes prior to the anthem that Trump would be doing this. Trump, an innate showman with a gift for playing to his base in these divided times, knew exactly what he was doing. For the next several months, the profile picture on his Twitter page was him standing with his hand on his heart for the national anthem. The message was clear. The NFL better fix its problems, or Trump would exploit this controversy in the coming election cycles. The apolitical world of football, thanks to Kaepernick's kneeling, the NFL's bungled response, and Trump's exploitation of the issue, had become as hot of a flashpoint as any in the world of politics. And as a result, the NFL had lost tens of millions of viewers, including my own father-in-law. At the time of publication, this controversy showed no signs of ending, but the final result was clear. Donald Trump had dunked all over Colin Kaepernick and the NFL. Chapter 8. The left-wing sports media desperately wants America to be an awful place. At 6:44 a.m. Pacific Time on May 31st, 2017, the day before the NBA Finals were set to begin, a phone call was made to the Los Angeles Police Department reporting a crime. It was a bright, sunny morning in the City of Angels, and the address given where the crime had occurred was a famous one, the West Los Angeles Brentwood area mansion of LeBron James. LeBron was not home, and neither was his family. James was in San Francisco preparing for Game 1 of the NBA Finals against the Golden State Warriors. Los Angeles police arrived at LeBron James's $21 million mansion within 10 minutes of the phone call. What they were told there was interesting. Someone had scrawled a racial slur on the gate of LeBron's mansion. But by the time the police arrived, LeBron's employees had already repainted the gate, and the only evidence the slur happened was a photo taken by LeBron's associates and provided to the police. That photo has never been released to the public. Later that day, TMZ broke the story of the racist graffiti outside LeBron's LA mansion, and the media frenzy was unleashed. LeBron's comparison of himself to civil rights martyr Emmett Till was universally praised, and the left-wingers in the sports media took the opportunity to laud James for his response to this awful atrocity. My response was different. I couldn't get past the fact that by the time the police arrived at LeBron's house, the racial slur on his gate had already been painted over. Who cleans up a hate crime scene if they want to catch the perpetrator of a crime? Wasn't that a bit odd? Instead of falling all over LeBron and praising him for being a victim, I did what media are supposed to do. I investigated the crime itself. What happened? Where did it happen? And who did it? When I asked those questions, I ran into some very interesting details. Did you know that over a year after the alleged racial incident happened, that the Los Angeles police still have zero independent evidence that a racial crime happened outside LeBron's Brentwood home? I bet you didn't. Do you know why you didn't know that? Because today's liberal sports media doesn't fairly and impartially cover the news. They pick the news that justifies their worldview and cover that instead. This chapter is about the failures of the far left-wing liberal sports media. It's about how the far left-wing liberal sports media only covers stories that confirm their existing worldview and rejects all stories that challenge that narrative. There are countless examples of stories like these, but we'll start our tour with the racist graffiti outside LeBron James's home, and then we'll move into the fake racism allegations of former Seattle Seahawk Michael Bennett. Then we'll touch on Ryan Lochte at the Olympics in Brazil. These stories have appeared in the past few years, and along with the Missouri fake protest we started the book with, they'll demonstrate unquestioned media bias. By the time we finish examining all these stories, I hope you'll all be more skeptical when you see the mainstream left-wing sports media rush to cover a story in a way that justifies their existing biases, that you'll all have taken the red pill. So was there ever a racial slur outside LeBron James's mansion? Let's return once more to the gate outside LeBron James's $21 million mansion at 6:44 a.m. on the day the crime was reported. When police arrived, the racial slur had already been painted over. This is what initially surprised me when I read the police report. How many of you arriving at a crime scene would immediately clean it up before police came to your house to investigate? Let's use an extreme example. If you walked into the front yard of your home, saw the door busted open and found a dead man there, would you clean up the mess around him before you called the police? Or would you leave everything exactly as it was and call the police? I bet there isn't a single person reading this book right now who would clean up the murder scene. Okay, you might be thinking, but this was just a slur on a gate. It wasn't a murder. That's fair. Let's use the exact same situation. If you had a slur or curse word painted on the side of your house, would you paint it over before you called the police to tell them about it? Or would you leave the slur or curse word there to be viewed by the police and then paint over it after they had conducted whatever investigation they needed to conduct? The first question about the alleged racial slur at LeBron's Los Angeles mansion, and it's an important one that has never been answered, is why did someone paint over the slur on the gate? If you were reporting a crime, wouldn't you leave the crime scene untouched? Isn't that the most basic of crime scene knowledge? Isn't the type of spray paint important here when it comes to catching the perpetrators? If you were worried about what the neighbors would think of the slur, couldn't you either cover the slur up with a bedsheet or, even simpler, open the gate since the gate slides open so as to be entirely invisible from the street? Furthermore, the people at LeBron's house already had the paint to repaint the gate at the house, and there was someone there to repaint it that early in the morning with the exact right color of paint and with that little amount of time passing between the call to police and the police arriving? Have you driven in LA traffic before? Unless LeBron employs a full-time painter who lives at the home, that seems just about impossible. And all of that happened before the police got to the house 10 minutes after the call? Doesn't that seem incredibly unlikely? Here's another point. LeBron's gate is easily visible from the street and sidewalk to anyone in the neighborhood. It rests directly on a major street with many driving by all day. There wasn't a single person out in Brentwood driving past, jogging, or walking their dogs early in the morning before police were called or this gate was repainted. Remember, police weren't called until 6:44 a.m. That's over an hour of daylight that would have passed before police were called. Presumably, the vandalism would have happened overnight, since if it happened during the daylight, it's even more implausible that someone wouldn't have taken photos. Toss in an additional half hour pre-sunrise when it's bright enough to see the gate clearly from the street, and we're talking about a couple hours when this racist graffiti would have been exposed to the entire neighborhood. Yet no one in the entire neighborhood took a photo or video during this time. If you lived in Brentwood and went driving or jogging past LeBron's house, everyone in that neighborhood would have known it was LeBron's house. And there was a racial slur on the gate. Are you really telling me nobody would have put that on Twitter, Facebook, Instagram, Snapchat, or at least sent the photo to TMZ? Instead, the LAPD spokesperson said that the police had been provided a photo of the graffiti. You read that right. The only evidence in this entire case is a photo that the police didn't even take themselves and that no one else has ever seen in public. If that's all the evidence there is, could you even prosecute someone here and get a conviction? No way. No defense attorney worth his salt is going to allow a photo like this to be entered into evidence without independent verification it existed. Remember, LeBron's people called the police and then leaked this story so we would know it happened. If LeBron didn't want the distraction or the media attention, he could have just painted over it and never given attention to this story. LeBron's crew wanted it to be public, but they didn't want to preserve the evidence? That doesn't make any sense at all. Unless, and this is one of the thoughts I had as I began to unpack this story, being a victim of racism was the best thing that could have happened to LeBron's brand. Indeed, if you were scripting a Hollywood movie about LeBron, wouldn't him being the victim of a racist attack the day before one of the biggest moments in his career, the rubber match NBA Finals against the heavily favored Golden State Warriors, be just about perfect for your story? What's more, if your entire brand at the time is about fighting for equality as the modern-day Muhammad Ali, is there anything better for LeBron's brand than being a victim of racism? Social justice warriors dream of being victims all day long, but direct racism is so rare in the country today that they spend most of their time now focusing on systemic racism and issues of amorphous white privilege. The left-wing sports media loves an innocent victim of racism. Hell, you get praised so much for being a victim today that there are hundreds of fake racist attacks happening all over the country every year. So it's strange to have cleaned up this racial slur. It gets even weirder from here. The gate with the alleged racial slur outside of LeBron James's home has a surveillance camera pointed at the gate. This isn't a surprise since most $21 million mansions have pretty high-tech security, particularly when the home isn't even occupied full-time, as was the case with LeBron's. Only, guess what? When the Los Angeles police requested the surveillance video showing the gate in an effort to identify and catch the perpetrator, they were told something fascinating. The surveillance video wasn't working that night. Oh. Well, isn't that convenient? So you've got a gate on a public street that has a surveillance camera visible to anyone who walks up to the gate. And someone who would have seen that surveillance camera right there still paints a racial slur on the gate? Boy, they were really lucky that the camera wasn't turned on that night, weren't they? No one in the entire neighborhood, not someone up walking their dog, going for a walk or a jog or driving to work early in the morning, sees the racial slur or someone repainting the gate, despite the fact that it would have been visible for nearly 2 hours and provides independent verification that it ever happened. And when the police arrive, the slur has already been painted over and there is no independent evidence it ever happened. And a year later, the Los Angeles police still have nothing to go on and no suspects. This entire story of a racial slur on LeBron's gate is a house of cards when you start to ask any questions at all. Yet everyone in the sports media believes it's 100% true and, even crazier, automatically assumes not just that it's true, but that the perpetrator is a racist white person. All this even though there is zero independent evidence that this incident ever occurred. Could a racist white person have written a racial slur on LeBron's gate? Sure. Could it just as easily have been someone trying to draw attention to racism who may well have been black or Hispanic or Asian? Definitely. Hell, could it have even been one of LeBron's employees trying to draw attention to himself? That seems even more likely to me. Not that LeBron was personally involved in making up a fake racism story, but that someone in LeBron's employ might see it as a way to increase LeBron's necessity for keeping him employed. What better way to prove how necessary you are to LeBron than to make him think his family might be in danger in Los Angeles? Regardless, I think all of you reading this right now would agree that this story doesn't make sense. Essentially, it just doesn't add up. This is even more the case now that LeBron has joined the Lakers in Los Angeles. If LeBron really thought a racist threatening his family was on the loose, would he move them to the very city where this crime is still unresolved? Now I want you to think about this for a moment. Why am I the only person in all of sports media even asking these questions? Why is this the first time that most of you have seen these questions asked? Isn't that the primary job of journalists in this country? To investigate stories and determine whether they are true or not. Why am I the only person you've seen asking these questions? Partly it might be my legal training. My criminal law professor told us there were only three things that mattered in any case: the facts, and the facts. With every story I cover, I try to come in with an open mind. I don't look for a case to confirm my existing worldview. I look at every case focusing entirely on the facts. You would have thought the sports media would have learned this lesson from the Duke lacrosse case, but they didn't. Partly it's also because just about everyone else in sports media is terrified they will be called racist if they question whether a particular act of racism could be true or not. Racism is awful and shouldn't exist. But believing a particular act of racism happened because racism exists is horribly flawed logic. And it's also because the left-wing sports media wants this story to be true because it confirms their existing worldview that America is an awful, racist place. The kind of place where Donald Trump could get elected president. Remember, as I told you earlier in the book, over 96% of sports media didn't vote for Donald Trump. Over 96%! Do you think groupthink might be an issue in this industry? If the LeBron story just stood on its own as a glaring flaw in the left-wing sports media's worldview, it might be an interesting anecdote. Nothing more. But this is evidence of a more systemic failure. The fake racism allegations of Michael Bennett are perfect evidence of yet another massive sports media failure. In the late summer of 2017, then Seattle Seahawk defensive end Michael Bennett traveled to Las Vegas for the Conor McGregor-Floyd Mayweather boxing match. After the fight, Bennett went out on the town, and according to him, during that night, he became the victim of police racism. Bennett's police racism allegation exploded on the national scene in September of 2017 when Bennett took his accusation directly to Twitter, posting a personal message accusing the Las Vegas police of racially profiling him under the tagline, "Equality." Immediately, the accusation raced through the country, receiving 400,000 favorites and hundreds of thousands of retweets. Bennett's explosive allegations that he'd been racially profiled and threatened with death by racist Las Vegas police officers because he was a black man became the lead story on television for ESPN, Fox, CBS, and NBC, and it surged to the top of every major sports website in America. Bennett asserted that when Las Vegas police responded to a report of an active shooter in a casino, they decided to tackle him for no reason other than his race. I was skeptical of Bennett's claims when I read them online, not because I didn't believe racism existed in the country, but because the story didn't make sense. Why would police decide to handcuff an innocent black man while they were investigating a potential live shooter at a casino? This was before the actual shooter in the Las Vegas casino killed over 50 people at a country music concert. Surely, I thought, there had to be something more to this story. Evidently, I was the only person to think this because the sports media spent the rest of the day lionizing Bennett for his bravery in the face of racist police officers. MSESPN, Fox, CBS, NBC, just about every radio station and newspaper in the country, all of them praised Bennett for being a victim. No one but me suggested maybe we should wait to see what the Las Vegas police have to say about this incident. If you said anything other than Michael Bennett was a hero and the police were awful human beings, you were a racist. The NFL even sent out a statement praising Bennett and castigating the Las Vegas police for their treatment of him. Then Bennett's story started to fall apart. First, TMZ released a video of the Michael Bennett handcuffing, and it looked downright normal. There were no screaming threats from the officers to blow his head off, or at least in this video, a gun placed anywhere near his head. If Bennett, as he alleged, was threatened that his head was going to be blown off, you certainly can't hear it. If the officer handcuffing him held a gun to his head, you certainly can't see that in the video either. Indeed, given the fact that we can hear almost the entirety of the arrest interaction, it seems pretty damn unlikely that there were any threats uttered at all. Later that day, the Las Vegas Police Department held a press conference and released a 5-minute video from inside the casino that night. The video showed how chaotic the casino had been, and it also revealed that officers entered the casino with weapons drawn and sought to protect the largely black audience exiting the casino. It always bears repeating, our police officers run toward violence while everyone else runs away from it. As you watch the men and women of the Las Vegas Police Department courageously walking through the casino looking for a shooter or shooters, it's hard not to admire their bravery. Most important, for purposes of Bennett's allegation, you can also see that the entire casino is full of black people. If police wanted to arrest black people, there were hundreds of them exiting the casino and receiving no molestation at all. Why was Bennett, a black man among hundreds of black people, singled out because of his race? How did that make any sense at all? Indeed, once you watch this video, Bennett's allegation that he was picked out because he's black is downright laughable. In fact, it's so laughable that Bennett's own attorney has acknowledged race had absolutely nothing to do with his treatment from the police. Near the end of the video, you can see Michael Bennett crouching behind a slot machine inside the casino, appearing to hide from police. When the police approached him because he appeared suspicious hiding there, he jumped up and ran away from them, refusing commands to stop, leaping a wall, and attempting to escape from them before being caught and detained. Shortly after releasing this video, Las Vegas police explained the evening in question and released a letter demanding the NFL investigate Michael Bennett for telling lies. As that letter asserts, as our uniformed officers entered the casino, they observed Bennett hiding behind a slot machine. When officers turned toward Bennett, he bolted out of the casino, leaped over a 4-foot barrier wall, and hid from officers as he crouched close to the wall on the sidewalk. The letter continues, I am sure that your attorney will tell you our officers had reasonable suspicion, which is the constitutional standard, to detain Bennett until they could determine whether he was involved in the shooting. Our officers, who are both minorities, had the legal right and obligation to detain Bennett based upon the nature of the call and Bennett's unusual and suspicious actions. Our officers did not detain Bennett because he was, quote, a black man in the wrong place at the wrong time. Michael Bennett's claims that our officers are racist is false and offensive to the men and women of law enforcement. We hope you will take appropriate action against Michael Bennett. Of course, the NFL did nothing to Bennett. Bennett would, however, be charged with a crime in Houston for allegedly shoving a 66-year-old paraplegic black woman and others en route to the field after Super Bowl 51. As these details emerged to cast doubts on Bennett's initial claim, something interesting happened. The same sports media that had feverishly covered Bennett's initial racism allegations went strangely quiet. Gone were the front page stories about Bennett's encounter with the racist Las Vegas police. Gone were the endorsements of his behavior and the condemnation of the police. The story just vanished. By the end of September, the Las Vegas Police Department had conducted a full investigation into Bennett's allegations. After reviewing 193 different videos of that night, remember, casinos are covered in cameras, and the police officers had cameras on them that night as well. The Las Vegas police released a 2-minute video that proved their officers didn't racially profile Bennett, didn't use excessive force, and treated Bennett with respect throughout their interaction. As anyone could see watching the videos, Michael Bennett looks incredibly suspicious, crouching and running when the police are looking for an active shooter. Police had a reasonable suspicion to stop and detain him. Remember, the police are responding to reports of an active shooter. What would a shooter likely do? Hide from police and then run from them and refuse their demands to stop when he saw them approach him, which is exactly what Bennett did in the videos. Far from being racist, it turns out that the Las Vegas police officers interacting with Bennett were minorities, two Hispanic officers and one black officer. As if that weren't enough, when these minority police officers detained Bennett, they were recorded on video politely explaining this entire scenario to him. Bennett even says he understands how his behavior would have looked to the officers. They then take his cuffs off. The entire time in the police car was 7 minutes, according to Las Vegas police, and are prepared to let him go. This is notably all before the police have any idea Bennett's a famous football player. That is, contrary to Bennett's allegation of racism, the police are treating him with respect and consideration long before they know that he's a multimillionaire pro athlete. They explain exactly why they detained him, explain why they were suspicious of his behavior, and then, and this is maybe the most amazing part of this entire story, they let him go after he identifies himself as an NFL player, even though he has no ID on him. "No, man, my name is Michael Bennett, Seattle Seahawks. Look it up," Bennett says when asked for ID by the police officers. He told the cops to look him up on their phones. And the cops looked him up on Google Images and let him go based on that ID. Talk about privilege. Bennett is out in Las Vegas without an ID. How is that even possible? It's not like he's a girl in a cocktail dress and heels. He can't carry a driver's license with him in his jeans pocket. He gets released from police custody by telling the police, after running from them and refusing to listen to their commands, that he plays in the NFL and to look him up on their phones. Racism? Get out of here. Michael Bennett is a huge beneficiary of NFL athlete privilege. How many people do you think get let go by police when they don't have an ID and have been stopped for suspicious behavior after telling the police to look them up on Google? Here's the kicker. Bennett then shook hands with police and told them he understood exactly what they had done. He shook hands with them. 2 weeks later, Bennett lied and called these same cops racist in a story that immediately went viral. When all of this factual evidence refuting everything Michael Bennett said comes out, do you know what happens in the sports media? Crickets. The story just disappears. Indeed, it doesn't just disappear. Bennett is, and I can't believe I'm writing this, nominated for the NFL Man of the Year Award, and the left-wing sports media continues its coverage praising his bravery and never asking him about his lies for the rest of the season. Bennett even sits for interviews with ESPN and NBC. Those interviews air on national television, and the sports media members interviewing him never even ask about the Las Vegas police incident. It's amazing to see happen, but I've seen it happen again and again over the past several years. A story appears to advance a left-wing agenda, is exposed as an untruth, and then vanishes from all media outlets. This is incredibly unfair because in covering Bennett's initial racism allegations and then not covering the fact that they were lies, the media does a disservice to the public and serves to further foment racial animosity between police and minorities. As I said before, I could use countless examples of this unfair and unequal treatment from the sports media to show liberal bias, but I'll only use one more here. It's another massive story that featured a superstar athlete and alleged police misconduct. For this story, we'll travel to the 2016 Olympics in Brazil. In the summer of 2016, Ryan Lochte and his American swimming teammates went out drinking after their Olympics ended and ended up stopping late at night at a Brazilian gas station to use the bathroom. While they were there to go to the bathroom, they were all robbed. Lochte later shared this story about the robbery with his mother, who shared it with a member of the American news media, and from there it blew up into a major international story. Eventually, Lochte went on the Today Show and shared his version of the story. That story, succinctly told, was this. Lochte and three swimming buddies went out drinking. On the way home to the Brazilian Olympic Village, they stopped to go to the bathroom. The bathroom door was locked, so the four swimmers peed in the grass outside the gas station. One of the American swimmers also bumped into a sandwich poster board hanging on the side of the gas station, leaving behind a scratch on the sign. At this point, two Brazilian gas station security guards arrived, pointed their guns at the American swimmers, and demanded money while screaming at them in Portuguese. Under gunpoint, the American swimmers gave the security guards the money in their pockets. The swimmers were then allowed to leave the gas station. Several days later, angry over all the media attention the incident was receiving, the Brazilian government then seized the passports of the three American swimmers still in the country, pulling two of them off the airplane as they attempted to return to America. One of the American swimmers was forced to pay nearly $11,000 in extortion money in order to leave Brazil, and all the swimmers were charged with making false statements to authorities. It would take over a year for the Brazilian courts to eventually resolve the issue, but in the summer of 2017, the Brazilian courts cleared the American swimmers of all wrongdoing. It turned out that their story had been correct all along. They'd been robbed on their way home from a night out drinking. Yet before all was said and done, the story was such a sports media feeding frenzy that Lochte would lose all his endorsement money and be suspended from competitive swimming for over a year. And for what? Getting robbed in Brazil. As if that weren't enough, somehow Ryan Lochte had, in becoming the victim of a crime, also become a poster child for white privilege. Over the past several years, the phrase white privilege has emerged as a collective phrase designed to summarize the supposed privileged treatment that white athletes receive compared to minority athletes. Lochte and all three of his teammates were white, and as the media story went, they were receiving preferential treatment based on their race. Lochte is actually half Cuban, but that didn't matter for this story. He was white because that made the left-wing sports media's views more readily apparent. This charge was led by who else? ESPN, which, and I'm not making this up, featured a front-page, heavily promoted website opinion piece arguing that Ryan Lochte was a perfect example of white privilege. The rest of the sports media followed the lead of this piece, ripping Lochte to shreds in the press, even though they were relying on indefensible logical fallacies and inaccuracies predicated on their pre-existing narratives. I'm going to deconstruct this story because I think it's a great example of the journalistic flaws you regularly find in the sports media today. Even though Lochte and his teammates have been cleared of all wrongdoing, you can still find tons of articles about how the men personified white privilege from virtually every mainstream media outlet in the country. Just Google it for yourself if you wish. ESPN's article on the subject was the most transparently absurd, beginning as it did as an open letter to white people. The article, written by a white man, literally begins, "Dear fellow white people, white privilege is a thing, and Rio was the perfect example." Oh, wow. This is absolute perfection, an open letter from a white guy in the media to other white people about white privilege. The ESPN article begins with a rallying cry. "I've just been working in the media for a long time, and this white privilege has become an issue that pisses me off to no end. The social tightrope that black athletes have to walk to avoid criticism is absurd, and at the same time, we can't help but always give white athletes the benefit of doubt. What unfolded in Rio is a great example of how far we still have to go." This is an important jumping off point because it elucidates the way many white people in sports media feel. White men in the media and white women are far more likely to rip white athletes than black athletes because even the allegation of racism is mortifying to them. For many white people in sports media, the worst thing you can say about them is to call them a racist. When white men misbehave, every white person in the media wants to line up and grab their pound of flesh. This way, when a black guy gets in trouble and white media are forced to talk about it, the white media can point to the way they treated Ryan Lochte and say, "Uh-uh, we're not racist. Look at what we wrote and said about Ryan Lochte." Now that the facts of Ryan Lochte and the American swimmers are public and we know they've done nothing wrong, this story joins a long litany of supposed white male wrongdoing that has been much ballyhooed and then disproved. Duke lacrosse, the made-up gang rape at a University of Virginia frat house, Peyton Manning's mooning of a woman at the age of 19 covered as a sex crime nearly 20 years later, and the Lochte case all have something in common. The American media decided that privileged white men were to blame and railroaded them, even though the facts didn't support their opinions. It's important before we go even further to make this point very clear. Most in the American media wanted Ryan Lochte to be in the wrong here because Lochte being in the wrong allows white people to beat up on white athletes.